Some of you have been here before. You're beginning to look very familiar to each other. And some of you haven't been here before, so I'm delighted to have you. Some people want to know what a spiritual director is, because that's such a strange word. I'm Catholic, and it's sort of a Catholic tradition. It's gone way back to monasteries in the 15th century, where people go and talk to another person, and you probably do this all the time, just don't call it spiritual direction. Talk to another person about your sense of God, or your sense of prayer, and how you're praying. And I get the privilege in my life to do that for a job. So people come over to my house and drink tea, and tell me about where they are with God, and how they're struggling with their life, and I feel very privileged to do that. And I've been very privileged this week to do this with all of you. What we've been doing all week is I've been inviting people into a sense of prayer, into a sense of worship, and then there's been a story that's been at the core of what we've been doing. And so I'm going to invite you in just a minute to stand up, and we're going to do a simple prayer. And then I'm going to read to you from Jane Smiley's book called 1,000 Acres. And I don't know if any of you have read 1,000 Acres, but it's this sort of startling book. And I promise not to read all the title for this evening. But it's a heavy book, but it's also a book full of cold things that I want to share with you. So I'll just sing that. As my poems get it. I sound worse, but I feel much better. Thanks. Archie, you just sat down in there, and I asked you to stand up again. Welcome, I'd like to see you, Archie. This is a simple kind of movement, and it's really about our bodies. And I think as men and women in this culture, we have all these skinny, blonde people on our magazines and on television. And we think we're supposed to look like that. And especially as we grow into middle age and get gray hair and pouchy stomachs and hips, we feel even worse. And I know that's true of men, because I have a pouchy belly stomach of a husband who's getting bald, and he feels sort of bad about his body, too. So it feels to me that the messages that we get are not about being compassionate with our bodies, and not about loving our bodies and blessing our bodies. So tonight what I'd like to do for you is play a tape of a friend of mine who's a dance therapist, and she wrote a song called "The Soul Loves the Body." And I've been thinking about the soul as the voice of God, that voice of kindness and compassion. So I'd like to play the tape for you. And then, I am not the musician in my family, and Steve just taught me this dance about an hour ago, and I'm not sure I have it right. But the movements are pretty simple, even I can do it. It starts like this, where you just clink your knees, and then you clink your right foot with the kick. And then again down, and then your left foot. And then your arm in a circle, and your left arm in a circle. Down again, right foot. Down again, left foot. And while your left foot is sort of out, you want to take your left arm and make a circle. And you're probably going to need some distance so you don't bang into the person standing next to you. So you may want to kind of move in and out of the circle so you've got some space. Show the chairs back as far as they'll go. I'll do it one more time in case you lost it. It took me a while to get this one too. So, thanks. Now we got lots more room. So knees go down, up, right foot, kick. Down, up, left foot, kick. Right hand, down with knees, right foot, down with knees, left hand around and circle. Great, you learned it much faster than I did. Now I'll put the words. There's a brief instrumental introduction, and then I'll start singing "The Soul Loves the Body." As soon as you've got the words, please start singing. And then in the middle, there's another part where there aren't any words, and you just may, if you like the movements, you just may want to keep moving, or you just may want to walk around the room and move your body. So in the middle, when the musical part comes, just see what the wild, intuitive part of you and your wonderful body want to do. Come on in and find a space. There's lots in here with me in the middle. First grade, kids would just crawl on the floor and fall asleep. So if you want to lay down on the floor while I'm reading a story, you want to take off your shoes, your belt, because you just had supper and maybe you're full, please do that. If anybody's chilly, all you need to do is get up and close the door. Whatever else you can do to get yourself comfortable, please do. Let's see, I think I'm going to sit next behind you two so that people can sort of sing. My voice is in the middle of a cold, but I feel much better than I did yesterday, especially after sort of last night was done. So here I am. 1,000 Acres, Jane Smiley. I'm an old English teacher, and I love finding...
I'm old.
Thanks, Kathy. I love finding authors that I like and then going back and reading their stuff. And I did that with Jane this summer as we were traveling and read some of her other books. And it's wonderful to see a soul develop and a writer. The first books that she wrote, they're sort of but this one, if you have not read 1,000 Acres, and if you're at all connected with farm life, it's, I've read it three times. And I've read it three times because I wanted to see how she got to where she was going. The book, it sounds sort of boring when I tell you what it's about. But as the life of these two women begins to change, I couldn't figure out how it all happened right before my eyes. So I'd really encourage you to go find this book and to read it.
It's in the library.
It's in the library.
I have it checked out. We'll be back.
It's also in the bookstore.
It's also in the bookstore. Oh, good. Great. Okay. And why am I telling you a story, and what does this have to do with feminist spirituality? Well, I'm going to let you guess. So keep that question. What does this have to do with feminist spirituality? And if you don't know anything about feminist spirituality, I'd invite you to ask anybody in the circle, because you all know what it is. You just maybe have not spoken it yet. And you'll probably get a lot of clues just by hanging out here tonight. The story begins, like the title, with land. 1,000 Acres. It begins in 1951. With Ginny, who's the 8-year-old narrator. And she's sitting in the back seat of her father's new Buick sedan, gray. She's sitting next to her 5-year-old sister, Rose, whom she adores. And in the front seat is her mother and father. And it's a very unusual Sunday afternoon when her father is not plowing up the land and planting his corn. And they've decided to take a new ride in their car.
And her father, as they drive, is checking all the fields of all the other farmers in the neighborhood and how far along the planting has gone. I can see some heads nodding. He must have grown up in Iowa or Nebraska or Michigan or wherever. And as he's driving, he's checking fields and animals, and the mother is checking gardens and houses and being sure that she's ahead of her neighbors, just as a father is checking out to see that he's ahead with the planting and the schedule. So as Ginny sits in the back seat, she has such a sense of comfort and security that her family is doing well. And there's a sense of safety and belonging, and she knows that everything is okay for a while. When she's 12 and Rose is 9, their mother dies of cancer. And at this time, their life began to be shaped differently because they had a younger sister, Carolyn, who needed to be taught how to tie her shoes, and a father who needed these two girls, to put breakfast, lunch, and supper on the table, and to clean the house on Saturdays. So they became adults at a very young age. Ginny and Rose grew like two trees planted in the same soil. They went to the same country grade school, the same country high school. And they married two men from the neighborhood who were also farmers. And these two men returned to the land of Ginny and Rose's parents. So these two men became indentured to the land as the two women were indentured to cooking and cleaning. Their houses, Ginny and Rose's, were within walking distance. It was on 1,000 acres. So they gardened together. Sometimes they cooked. One of them would cook breakfast for the whole crew of people working in the fields, and the other would cook lunch for the whole crew of people in the fields. They gardened together. They took in the vegetables together. They gossiped together. They told all of their stories together. When Rose had 5 miscarriages, and there's a whole beginning sense of women and cancer who grew up on cornfields where there was a lot of fertilizer and a lot of chemicals. When Rose had 5 miscarriages, when Ginny had 5 miscarriages, Rose was there. When Rose had her 2 children, Ginny was there for parenting to help out. When Rose had breast cancer diagnosis, it was Ginny who took her to the doctor. And it was at this point that Ginny says, "We drove the rest of the way from the doctors, silently. A glaring haze lay over the fields to either side of the road, and the rows of just sprouted corn fanned into the distance like seams of tiny bright stitches against dark wool. When I dropped Rose at her house, she hugged me. The fact was that we had known each other all of our lives and had never gotten tired of each other. Our bond had a peculiar fertility that I was wise enough to appreciate, and also, perhaps, enough to appreciate in silence. Rose wouldn't have stood for any sentimentality." Early in this story, Ginny and Rose's and Carolyn's 74-year-old father make a momentous decision that he will bequeath 1,000 acres to his 3 daughters, which at this point are worth $3 million. 1,000 acres in Iowa at that time was worth $3 million. Carolyn, the youngest daughter, at this point is a lawyer. She lives in the city, and when the father makes the announcement, she hesitates and says, "I'm not sure." He immediately cuts her off and rages against her. The two husbands take over the supervision of the field work, and the father rages against those two men. A week later, at a picnic in their town, the father rages against the two families, his 2 daughters, their husbands, and their 2 nieces. In front of everybody, he embarrasses them. And that night, he gets arrested for a DWI. And the rest of the story is a gradual declining in his ability to think, to reason. You can could see senility begin to creep into this man as soon as he gives away his land. And he refused to stop giving it away and started a lawsuit. So he hires a lawyer who turns out to be Carolyn. So Carolyn and he do a lawsuit against Ginny and Rose to get the land back. As soon as she saw me, she said, "Wait till you hear this. Mary Livingston has been over to Harold's twice. She thinks Daddy's lost his mind. I just talked to him. He," Rose muttered, "this enrages me." "What? This ploy? Rose, he's sick." She lowered her voice, grasped the front of my shirt, and pulled me to her. "I know this. I know that his face is a black ocean, and there's always, always the temptation to drown in that ocean, to just give yourself up and sink. You've got to stare back. You've got to remind yourself what he is, what he does, what he did to us as children. Daddy thinks history starts fresh every day, every minute. The time itself begins with the feelings he's having right now. That's how he keeps betraying us. Why he roars at us with such conviction. We have to stand up to that and say, at least to ourselves, that what he's done before is still with us, still right here in this room. And it will be until he's remorseful. Nothing will be right until then." "But Rose, he looks weakened." "Weakened is not enough. Destroyed isn't enough. He's got to repent and feel humiliation and regret. I won't be satisfied until he knows what he is." Do we know what we are? We know we aren't him. We know that to that degree, we don't yet deserve the lowest place in hell. It was incredible to hear Rose speak like this, but it was intoxicating too, as sweet and forbidden as anything I had ever done. I couldn't resist her. I said, "Rose, I understand. I'm with you." She planted a kiss on my cheek and let go of my shirt. I saw that some people were looking at us. So at this point, their world not only cracks, but some pieces begin to fall apart so much that they can't be glued together again. Rose's husband gets drunk and drowns himself. Ginny leaves her husband and moves to the city. The farm, worth $3 million, goes into bankruptcy. The father dies. The family has disintegrated and the land devastated. But the absolute worst thing of all is that Rose and Ginny's relationship is also destroyed by a sense of betrayal. Both of them had unhappy marriages. A man that they went to high school with, who had gone to Canada during the draft, returned. Both women fell in love with him. And Rose, Ginny had a sexual encounter with him, was deeply in love with him, and Ginny knew that, and she began to be sexual with him. And when Rose found out, she could not abide the betrayal, and that's when she moved to the city. And she began a life as a waitress at Perkins. She did that because she needed something to numb out, so she would not think of the betrayal and the loss and the sadness. And she stayed living in the city for 3 years until Rose called. Rose said, "I've had a recurrence of my cancer and I'm dying. Will you come?" Ginny, you don't let me to say what I really think. I need you. I don't want to alienate you. I haven't changed my mind about Daddy, or the farm, or what was done to us. But if I repeat myself, you could just walk out of here. I don't trust you. I don't trust you. Well, there you are then. Except that what is there about me not to trust? I'm stuck here. She stretched out her spider web hands and spread her skinny arms wide. Tears prickled in my eyes. I said, I guess I was also set to fight, but not anymore. Yeah, I'm 37. It shits, doesn't it, to be dying? I said, it's hard to bear. At that moment, it seemed impossible to bear. I exclaimed, oh, Rose. She sniffled, dismissing this upsurge of feeling. After a moment, she said, don't do that to me. We're not going to be sad. We're going to be angry until we die. It's the only hope. I don't know if I can do that, especially without you to goose me. I'll just fall back into the muddle. At the hearing, I was so shocked. I mean, he was so lost and diminished. I felt like I couldn't remember what we were so afraid of, except that you could, so I could. And then I could see you so clearly all those last 3 years, how you'd always had your way at my expense, and you'd been selfish all your life. I just saw those words in red letters. Rose is selfish. And I didn't have any trouble being hard and having everything you did and said and had everything and everything you've ever done go for evidence that you were immovably selfish, and that's bad. I mean, if we don't know that about being selfish is bad, then what did we learn as children? Rose laughed. In that drab hospital room, it was a jolly sound. I liked it and was offended at the same time, so I confessed, maybe just to impress her, make her serious again, I said, I thought I was going to be angry with you forever, but now I'm not. I mean, I wanted to kill you. So what? I want to kill people all the time. No, I don't mean that. Gee, I don't mean I could kill that guy. I mean, I set out to kill you. I made poison sausage for you and canned it and waited for you to eat it. She looked at me, surprised at last. Finally, she said, well, must have worked. Don't you remember that liver sausage and sauerkraut I brought over? She shook her head. Right around dinner, late in the summer. Vaguely, so much was going on, I must have forgotten about it. Then, of course, I was swept up in the Jess Clark lifestyle, the man she loved. So I would have spurned liver sausage, even if I'd remembered. She drank some water through a straw. I said, aren't you even impressed? I guess I think if you really wanted to kill me, you would have shot me or something. Ty had a shotgun. So did Daddy and so did Pete. Anyway, you didn't have to bother. All that well water we drank did the trick. And now I have kids. I nodded, limp from my confession, slumping in my green chair and damp with sweat. Rose, on the other hand, looked invigorated and said, it must still be in the cellar, then. Everything else is, but that house has been boarded up since I moved across the road. I felt a surprising surge of relief. We exchanged our first smile since I'd come. I should leave if I want to get home before the girls do. They want to come this afternoon. Then I said, what am I going to do without you? Exercise caution while making up your mind, as always. every other container for these women was broken. The land, their family, their marriages. Nothing held except their relationship, and their relationship made it through betrayal and poison. What held them together as children, that bond, that connection, lasted a whole lifetime through amazing, awful experiences. What does all this have to do with you and me? There's a Vietnamese monk whose name is Thich Nhat Hanh. Do you know of him? He was a monk during the Vietnam War. He goes around our country and the world teaching people to meditate and forgiving us Americans for destroying his country. I got the opportunity to be with him this year in Berkeley, and he taught us a walking meditation. And I'd like to teach it to you. It's very simple, except it's a little hard to do in this room with so many people in this little room. But will you try it anyways? It's simply walking and breathing and paying attention to your body as you walk. And in this room, you'll need to pay attention to not banging into somebody else. But it simply is putting one foot in front of the other, picking up the back foot, and very slowly putting down the other one. So that what you're doing is noticing your body in motion. So I invite you just to simply walk this way, breathing. Maybe if we all walk kind of in the same direction, that would help.
That would help,
yeah. So notice your breath. Notice the tiny, tiny muscles in your feet. And see how much you can slow down your walking. If it helps to take off your shoes, you may want to do that. Breathe. Notice your body. As you walk, I want to ask you questions. Let them go if they don't connect with you. Pay attention to the question that may zing in your body. Rose and Ginny loved each other over many years. Is there another person, man or woman, who has been a kindred spirit for you over many years? A sister, a brother, or like a sister or a brother.
Usually there is joy in having a kindred spirit in your life. Has there also been pain with this person? Try out the word sister with God. Could you call God sister? Do you have any feeling at all that God betrayed you? Where are you in God at this moment? Breathe. Notice your body. I invite you to continue walking if you want. If you feel like you would like to sit down with one person or two people to speak about the story, to speak about your life, would you do that if you want? And if you just want to keep walking and meditating in this way, you can do that. Feel like you'd like to continue the walking meditation and don't want to do it in here, you can just walk out the door and walk outside with the deer. Come back in about 15 minutes if you want for closing time. So the options are to keep walking in this room, to sit down and talk about what question touched you, or to walk outside in solitude.
off. Teachers get a day off. And I'll be back on Saturday. And I'm struggling with another story to read you, so I don't know if I'll read it or not. So I'll see you on Saturday, if not before, in the village someplace.
What time on Saturday?
Say, Jan, would you say Grandmother God?
Thank you. Some people were here when I did Grandmother God poem and they wanted a copy. So if you can get yourself a piece of paper and a pen, I will say it out loud and you can write it down. I don't have a paper or pen, but if you can find one, I'll do it right now. There's some paper over here if somebody needs one. Got paper? Are you all sitting? Oh, great. You ready? She was shelling peas. She was shelling peas. Apron covered knees. Spread wide to catch each pea, each pod. I, shaky, needy, wandered near. Her swollen hands pushed back the hair.